very much, and it's lovely to be speaking at Fox News. And Liz, thank you very much for inviting me. And also, Liz has been very kind because I did agree to talk about humanitarian action, but I've been talking about humanitarian action for about 40 years now. And I'm at the moment much more excited about nature and about the nature emergency and what I call the Earth emergency, the combination of a climate emergency and a nature biodiversity emergency. So, Liz and Harry, you're very kind, so I can talk about that instead. And I'm going to talk about making peace with nature. And I want to really talk today about the important obligation that we all have, locally, nationally, and internationally, to make peace with nature and the other life around us, and to recognise nature more formally in our human politics. And I think this means two things. In our own lives, it means respecting and caring for nature in everything we do. Internationally, this means moving from simply being an international community of human states to a new sense of being an earth community of all life. And that is very much the idea of a wonderful American Catholic theologian called Thomas Berry, and I very much follow him in this respect. And so for our beloved United Nations, I think to take nature and the earth seriously and to think about international relations as an earth community of all life, for the United Nations, in my view, this means opening up the Charter, reviewing the Charter, which we can do if we get two-thirds of states agreeing to do that, and rewriting the UN Charter so that it is properly centred on protecting the Earth and not just humans, and therefore reorganising UN agencies so that all their mandates value humanity and nature together in their approach to development and justice. And the term making peace with nature has emerged really from the United Nations and also particularly from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN, in Switzerland, in recent years. And I think it's a good phrase for all of us in our everyday life and in our political life and internationally. So I'm going to look at three aspects of this idea as we are beginning to explore it across the road from here at Blackfriars at the Cassis Institute for Social Justice. And I'm going to think about how making peace with nature relates to human consciousness, to international diplomacy, and to the ethics of war. So I'm going to think about three things: nature as a neighbour, nature as diplomat, and nature and war. And I'm going to start with nature as neighbour, which is the sort of umbrella term that we are giving to our work at Las Casas across the road. And of course, if we think of the last 4,000 years, probably one of the great moral achievements embodied in the United Nations that we've made as a species is to agree the idea of humanity and of a common humanity, and to recognize, albeit in varying degrees, the moral equality of all human beings in this idea of humanity. And therefore we have, in various ways, gradually and unevenly over time, and in the United Nations, come to see each other as neighbours on the earth. And of course, for Christians, this is fundamental because it comes from, you know, inevitably a question from a lawyer to Jesus, which is, who is my neighbour? And Jesus, of course, classically answers with the story of the good Samaritan. And that means any human is the answer, in a sense. But the price I think we've paid for this sort of elevated sense of humanity is to create this idea of us as a sort of super species, that somehow floats above the earth. And of course, that is not true. We don't do that as human beings. We don't float free of the earth as a sort of separate, single species, this thing called humanity. And this is what we have to rediscover today, that human life and humanity is always a hybrid existence, a coexistence. There is no human life without other life. There is no human life without water, without rocks, without soil, and without the gases in which we live. So we are always a hybrid form of life with other life, where water humans and meat humans and air humans and sandwich humans in this case today. And that's how we are. And Pope Francis, in his great encyclical Laudato Si, has really refined and I think explicitly extended our sense of neighbour to include all life on earth, in our common home, as he calls it, on earth. And he called, in that encyclical, for an ecological conversion of the heart, which sees nature as our neighbour too, and therefore the subject of our compassion and our obligations. And therefore he talks in the encyclical about we don't just turn and cross the road and look after a wounded human. We are as much moved and responsible for our neighbour that might be a polluted river or a burning forest or dehydrated animals, etc. So I think this is a really important move in our sense of neighbour in the 21st century. And it's a really urgent one too, in the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis. So this new sense of nature as our neighbour ends the traditional ideas of domination and exploitation of nature that existed in some Catholic doctrine. And a conversion, of course, converso, is a turn towards, so a turn towards nature, and a commitment to seeing other life around us as our neighbour, with whom and in whom we are interdependent for life. So this conversion is, of course, and quite obviously, a sort of return of modernism to a pre-modern human consciousness and ethics that's long been held by traditional and indigenous peoples. And in many ways, it's the diplomacy of indigenous peoples over the last 40, 50 years, actually probably 100 years, that has really kept that human consciousness of nature as a neighbour alive in international relations and centred it once more. So, the commitment to nature as neighbour is a commitment to find a just and positive peace in the coexistence and mutual flourishing with other life around us. And in our domestic politics, this demands that we recognize nature as a political subject and increasingly accord it political status, political representation, and rights. Countries like Ecuador have done this in their constitution. In New Zealand, as we know famously, one of the great rivers there has been given five guardians in Parliament to act as the human face of the river in the New Zealand Parliament. And this kind of work, I think, is very important, and we need to do it. It's crucial to that part of making peace with nature, bringing it into our politics. And we need to move this way in the UK too, so that nature, in the form of ecosystems, species, natural formations, have a seat at the table in local and national boards and institutions. And so that our governance becomes not simply democratic, but much more biocratic too. So that's this idea of nature of neighbour as neighbour, which I think is the first big shift in human consciousness and political approach that we need to take, that sees nature as a neighbour and a political subject around us. The second dimension of that is this idea of nature as diplomat, which we're also working on. So if nature is our neighbour, what does this mean in international relations? It means that nature needs to become more diplomatic too. And this is why we're researching the idea of nature as diplomat. In the earth emergency of the 21st century, multilateralism must also involve multi-species representation and interspecies diplomacy if we are to take nature and the earth seriously in global politics. Of course, for hundreds of years now, well, certainly 70, 80 years now, we've had the pioneering role of the great nature organizations like WWF, Greenpeace, Global Witness, and the IUCN, umbrella group of nature organizations. They've led the way of bringing nature to the table in some way and into politics. And they've secured a real stake for nature in international environmental law, in many treaties, not least the Rio Convention on Biodiversity, but many others before that as well. But I think we need to go further in diplomacy. I think we need more than experts and lobby groups persuading politicians about nature. I think we need innovative new forms of diplomatic representation for nature, for oceans, for rivers, for soil, for ice, for particular species. The human sphere needs to listen much more to the cryosphere, the biosphere, and the pedosphere. And this means that these spheres need embassies and ambassadors of some kind. So how can we do this? And we're working at the moment with the Graduate Institute in Geneva, exploring different models of this. And we're having a round table next month in Geneva, where we're bringing nature activists and academics together with diplomats in Geneva to explore the idea of nature as diplomat. What does it mean? How could we do it? And pilot some experiments in Geneva. So much is already underway, as you'd expect, because people have been innovating around this for some time. We have river representation in politics, as I've mentioned. We're getting more of that in the UK with recognition at council level of the rights of certain rivers. We have the Dutch organising a very innovative way of working on what they call the Embassy of the North Sea. So they try and represent the interests of the North Sea politically and diplomatically through various methods. We have a wonderful woman in Exeter, who's an Aussie actually, who is the first UN ambassador for migrating species. And she flies with migrating geese and all sorts of vultures and things around Africa in her little gyrocopter thing and flies with them and brings their interests to the table in Geneva and New York. And, of course, we have a very interesting campaign, and we welcomed them at Black Trials last year, and they've been in Geneva with us, called Antarctic Rights, who are some South Africans and others who are arguing that Antarctica should be the first nature sovereign at the UN, and that it should be recognised with a seat at the UN as Antarctica. And these ideas are extremely interesting, and I think we need to keep working on them to make sure that we include nature in diplomacy in a subjective sense and not just talking about it in some way, so that somehow we can give nature a diplomatic political voice. And this all becomes a tussle about sovereignties, of course, as you can imagine. But I believe that human sovereignties can coexist and do coexist every day. And they can coexist and negotiate with overlapping nature sovereignties. Archbishop Rowan said this morning that diseases and things don't see borders, they don't have passports, and that's totally obvious. There's a wonderful French philosopher who works with wolves, and you can see all the maps of what is wolverine and wolf's territory, and it just completely crosses human borders. But we can respect that sovereign wolf lupine territory or whatever, at the same time as we can respect ours. We can operate with an idea of multiple and overlapping interspecies sovereignties. And we can talk about that at the UN, I think. And in my garden, which is a very small little garden, I'm always interested that, of course, in my garden, I think it's mine. But of course, if you watch the birds there, it's quite clear that it's part of their territory. And if you watch the snails and the slugs, it's very clear to them that it's their territory as well. And so with the insects and the plants and everything. But our sovereignty overlaps. We can pool our sovereignties in my back garden, up to a point, and that will be the rub for realpolitik. But I think we can do it, and we must be creative and imaginative about it. We don't have to apply a Westphalian system anymore to the whole Earth in that way, if we believe in an Earth community of all life. So, as in my garden, so it must be on Earth, I think, a recognition of multiple sovereignties, overlapping sovereignties, and all life representation in the plain sea. And before I die, I would love to see a new form of multilateralism in Geneva, where there are diplomats speaking from forest embassies covered in tumbling greenery over their buildings, where there are ocean embassies with spokespeople speaking for oceans, and where animal embassies like the bird lady and others are representing the interests of various animals and insects and all sorts of things around the world, and negotiating the best ways to cohabit the Earth, to keep it as the beautiful blue planet that humans have now seen from space in the last century for the first time. And there's precedent for this, because if you look at the 20th century diplomacy, and Geneva in particular, which is the place I know best, diplomacy expanded during the 20th century extraordinarily to welcome and let in all sorts of new political subjects into diplomatic institutions, diplomatic representations, international law of all kinds. So, first of all, we have the inclusion of independent states who were previously colonized. These new sovereignties were recognized. But then we have women being recognized in institutions and international law and diplomacy, children, refugees, and civilians in war. So we have been innovative about new political subjects of international diplomacy and international law many times before. And now we need to include nature as well. Finally, I'm going to talk about nature, war, and peace. And this is the third aspect of nature we're looking at Las Casas at the moment. And this question of nature, war, and peace, I think, takes four forms. Nature as civilian, nature as victim, the weaponization of nature, and nature in peacemaking. And I'll whiz through them quickly. So nature as civilian. The great news is that nature already has legal personality in the Geneva Conventions, because the environment is recognized as fundamentally civilian and immune from deliberate attack, like human civilians. So we see the precedent in the Geneva Conventions of legal personality for the environment, for nature in that way. But of course, as we know, nature is a huge victim of war, probably much greater loss of life in nature than humanity in every war there is. Whenever you see an explosion, the death of other life is quite phenomenal across multi-species and everything. So nature is a terrible victim of war, not just from the emissions of all the war machines which go on building up global warming and emitting fossil fuels, etc., but the sheer destruction and pollution of war in every war. We've seen it in the last few weeks graphically again, that nature is, in a sense, the supreme casualty of civil war. And the next thing is the weaponization of it. And since time immemorial, nature has been used in defense and attack as a weapon, in a sense. It's the most ancient human practice. So ever since the first person cut a branch off a tree and decided to use it as a club, or put a bit of flint on a thin bit and use it as an arrow or a spear, we have, in a sense, weaponized nature. And if we ourselves are nature as humans, we've weaponized ourselves as nature through our minds and through our bodies to become weapons bearers. As nature, if you like. And of course, the ultimate form of that is to split the atom, one of the fundamental building blocks of the natural physical world, and create a bomb. There is also not just the creation of weapons from nature, but there is also deliberate strategic weaponization of landscape in war. And we've seen this all through history, in the terrible policy of scorched earth, where you burn an area of crops or forest so your enemy is deprived of it, and use that as a weapon of war to starve and displace your enemy. But we see it also in, you know, the tactics to lure people into dangerous nature like swamps or deserts or water, where you lure them in and then once they're stuck and suffer. And of course, the great Sun Tzu, the great original, most ancient written military tactician we have, was a great advocate of let the landscape beat your enemy, use nature to defeat your enemy and win in a war without a fight, that sort of logic. And we see that today. We're going to see it a lot more, I think. We see it in the Straits of Hormuz today, where you have a power that, in a sense, weaponizes a natural formation as a choke point of global trade, that is, in a sense, using a natural formation as a weapon. We're going to, I worry, think, see it in hybrid warfare. If we have heat waves here and it suits the odd arsonist to start a forest fire, we could see hybrid warfare and nature being used as a weapon in that way. And we can see dams being burst to flood whole territories to use that water as a weapon as well. And these are all ancient traditions of weaponizing nature, and they pose a big challenge to us. And they are covered to a degree in the Geneva Conventions, but again, as others have said this morning, we need to, as the French would say, précise these areas like drones and air and environmental warfare, and probably geo-economic warfare too, more specifically. Finally, nature as peacemaker. The good news is there are some signs from important peace mediators like the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva and Conciliation Resources in London that people can and must come together through nature to make peace. And there are community initiatives of everyday peace, or as was said today, good enough peace, all over parts of the Sahel and others, around wells and pasture and land and sea, in which nature is at once the incentive for making peace, because we need access to this nature, but also the means of making peace, because you make deals through agreements of sharing nature that are imperative for you. And this environmental mediation, this ecological peacemaking, is really coming up the agenda fast now, which is important. So I'm going to stop there and just conclude by, in a sense, what I've been trying to say are some of the ingredients I see in our need to make peace with nature in the 21st century. First, this recognition, recognizing nature as our neighbor, our ecological conversion to a sense of earth community beyond international community. Secondly, conversing with nature as a diplomat in some way, in new forms of multilateralism, where nature has diplomatic presence and voice in some way at the table. And then thirdly, focusing hard on the role of nature in war-making regulation and in peacemaking practice. So thank you for listening to me about nature, not humanitarianism.